Coming up on Weekend America.
This is not Halloween weekend. It's scarier.
As he says, "Hello, I'm from the Internal Revenue Service." That's when you immediately get that feeling in the pit of your stomach of, what have I done?
The day the revenuer knocked on the door and other memorable tax moments. Desiree Cooper is away. I'm Bill Radke. Also this hour, if I tell you someone was talking like a spoken word poet, you know what I mean.
And then the moon shined, and it shone and shone and shone until the sun came out, and then that's what we make fun of in the spoken word world.
Where did poetry speak come from, and why has it stayed? And if you feel yourself getting addicted to a sport, beware.
Just like taking dope, you know what I mean? Playing golf. A guy falls in love with it so much, I mean, it's just something you just can't get away from.
And where there's addiction, there is the hustler. Hear his story on Weekend America after the news.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, welcome to the weekend. Desiree Cooper is away. I'm Bill Radke in Los Angeles. For National Poetry Month, there is a poetry slam this weekend at the City Library in Springfield, Massachusetts. Now, I don't know what this slam is going to sound like, but there is a sound that a lot of poetry readings have. You know what I'm talking about? That cadence, that distinctive way poets have of declaiming their written word. Where did that come from, and why has it stuck? We'll answer that question later this hour. Peace. What about you? What are you doing this weekend?
This weekend, I'm going to work on my 1963 Austin Healey.
I'll probably be mowing grass if the weather's fit.
Probably try to get out and do a run.
I'm actually going to see The Lion King from Broadway.
I was planning on bringing my children down here to Centennial Park, and we were going to feed the ducks.
Ride my fixed-gear bicycle around, because that's the hip thing to do here in San Francisco.
I will spend all my nights dancing salsa. And maybe reggae, too, all night.
All right, and those voices came from Atlanta, Nashville, and San Francisco. Well, you have time to listen to Weekend America and then take a nap and then salsa and reggae all night. Thank you for tuning in. Several years ago, it was the last weekend before the tax filing deadline. So, of course, I was at Seattle Public Library, which was being kept open until midnight. All us procrastinators were there together getting all our forms, borrowing calculators and pencils, and having the nice lady postmark our envelopes for us. And the local King 5 news team was there with the camera crew doing their annual story about the losers who can't get their lives together. And I agreed to be interviewed, and I gave them a funny little quote. And the quote was especially funny to my recently ex-girlfriend, who placed a rare phone call to me the next day just to tell me she had seen me on the news and that I would never, ever change. So if you're suffering this weekend, I'm with you. I've been there. I was in country. Whether you're filing this weekend or you finished 2 months ago, take a break now from your deducting or your gloating and listen, because we asked you to tell us your best tax stories.
My name is Richard Seaton Holt, and Dad's name is Richard Holt, no middle name. Well, in 1970, I was in high school. I was 17, and I had a summer part-time job working for a contractor. Also, my parents at that point had sold a ranch, and they were receiving proceeds from it. Late that summer, there was a knock at the door, and I answered it. As he says, "Hello, I'm from the Internal Revenue Service," that's when you immediately get that feeling in the pit of your stomach of, what have I done? He wanted to talk with Richard Seaton Holt. He says, "And I want to know why you haven't paid taxes on your $117,000 income. I'm making about $80 a week, so I haven't a clue where the money is because I didn't know the branch sold and the first payment was $117,000. I was just happy to have made around $3,000. And somewhere along the way, we assume it was at the bank, they just mixed up the names."
I'm Paula Presley, and I live in Kirksville, Missouri. I worked in a one attorney office, and he told me that in doing income tax, he was expecting one client to come in. He was an old, retired Catholic priest, while he was waiting for the attorney to see him, the priest asked me if he could deduct his gambling losses. And I had just read in a tax preparation manual that that could be done. And I said, you can deduct your gambling losses only to the extent of your winnings. In other words, if you've lost $5,000 and you've won $1,000, you can only deduct $1,000 of your losses and no more. I finished the man's income tax form, and after he left, the attorney called me in and he says, I want to know how it is that you, a Baptist pastor's wife, happen to know that you could take gambling losses when I, who have gambled for a long time, didn't know that. And we had a good laugh over it.
When we do our taxes, we usually get around $500 back. I am Lenora Johansson from Phoenix, Arizona. This year we decided to have a professional do our taxes. This is the very first time we did not do our taxes ourselves. We were nervous that we were going to owe money, or possibly we had the hope that we would break even. And after going through everything, all the deductions we were eligible for, the lady told us we were getting over $12,000 back. My husband and I looked at each other and we're both completely shocked. And we thought she had actually made a mistake and asked her to look it over again. Because my husband uses his truck for work, we were able to deduct the special tires he needs, the special insurance policy he has to have on his vehicle, and all the maintenance costs for his vehicle because he had put 40,000 miles on his truck in 1 year purely for work. And after everything had been added up, it was around $20,000 we were able to deduct. I looked in our checking account and saw that the money had been deposited and immediately called my husband and told him we had the biggest checking account balance we had ever seen. I've questioned it a million times. Is this really happening? Do we really get this much money back? Do we really have this kind of money in our checking account right now? But it's true. It's there. No one can take it.
You can check out the original listener stories at weekendamerica.org. Okay, so those stories were from the taxpayers. What about the stories from the tax receivers? Bob Branson worked for the IRS for more than 20 years. He's retired now and is the host of All Things Considered in Austin, Texas. Bob has seen his share of memorable moments at the IRS office he worked in, like the time a certain famous country singer had to come clean about his taxes.
Well, this is over a decade ago. Willie Nelson had some really serious tax problems. IRS had seized just about everything that the poor guy owned, and he wound up coming to IRS with an appointment, he and his tax lawyer. He was leaving the building, and word had gotten around to the employees that Willie Nelson was in the building. So all these employees' heads kind of popped out the doors, looking in the hallways. And when they saw Willie, a lot of them came out and asked for his autograph. And Willie stopped and signed autographs and posed for pictures with every IRS employee who requested it. I gained a lot of respect for Willie Nelson that day.
What's a taxpayer's story that has lingered with you?
If you do not have a regular paycheck where a certain amount of money is deducted each paycheck to pay taxes, then you are expected to make quarterly estimated payments because it is a pay-as-you-go system. So one time the IRS received a check from someone. It was made out to IRS and it had a dollar figure on it, but there was no name anywhere on the check. And attached to the check was a note that says, "Dear IRS, here is my estimated income tax. You'll note there is no name on it. If I have to guess how much I'm going to make, you can guess who sent it in."
Why do you keep all these stories?
I keep these stories because they are just a good reminder of what I used to do. When I first went to work for the Internal Revenue Service, I thought, boy, this is going to be a gold mine for humor and tempering the image of the agency with humor had to be good for the image.
Bob Branson, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Bob says this weekend he will be awaiting his refund check. And you can find the original tax stories from our listeners at weekendamerica.org. It was Benjamin Franklin who first famously said that nothing in this world is certain but death and taxes. So while some people are doing taxes this weekend, Jeff Horwich looks around and sees that other thing.
Well, April's here, and what's in the air? Mourning, sorrow, grief, despair. Not what you'd expect when spring arrives. If you were expecting the birds and bees, well, there's some kind of mystery bee disease, but worrying honey just makes you break out in hives. Now, I don't care much for flying rats, but in New York, something's been killing bats. Step lightly, you might find one on your lawn. And the big Sacramento salmon run is like empty. It's not clear what we done, and we don't know yet what trouble this might spawn. The polar bears up north have seen their ice turn to a lake. It looks like that Canute's the one who caught the lucky break. Bees and bats and fish and bears, they'll sting you, they'll bite you, they're slimy and fierce, but all them suckers make the world go round. If death is just one of the facts of life, then this is like a marathon on Nick at Night, and Tootie winds up 6 feet underground. You know, it ain't just animals passing away. There's more stuff dying on us every day, and we might as well pay homage while we're here. How about that HD DVD or the whole darn music industry? And let's all give last rites to Robin Williams' career. The American dollar is kicking up dust. The American dream is starting to rust. The middle class could bow out any day. Neoconservatism is lost at sea. Ralph Nader killed his legacy. And let's all wave goodbye to my 401k. Baseball struggled long and hard, but finally died last year. The unofficial cause of death?
A needle in the rear.
The newspaper industry's pretty much toast. Paper checks are giving up the ghost, and the local bookstore's very nearly through. They say in life two things are certain, and neither one comes without plenty of hurting. And sure as the sun comes up, they both come due. Yeah, sure as the sun comes up, they both come due.
That's Jeff Horwich, host of the Minnesota Public Radio show In the Loop, with a tune he calls the Happy Death Song. Jeff played guitar, ukulele, harmonica, and sang. Joe Wiseman played bass. Thanks to Tom Mudge, Sam Keenan, and Rob Byers for helping record it. You can find more ditties just like this one at minnesotapublicradio.org/intheloop. And by the way, you can also download a full-length version of the Happy Death Song at our website. Go to weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week.
Coming up, an auto racing official is a whipping boy, Walmart gets sold out, and they're playing hide the torch on good news, bad news, or no news, next on Weekend America. We'll be right back. This is Weekend America. I'm Bill Radke without Desiree Cooper. She'll be back next week. Right now, we're talking about this week. This is the part of the show where we choose a few arresting developments from the week gone by and decide whether they were good news or bad news, or no news at all. With us today, the creative director for Barney's New York, Simon Doonan. Welcome, Simon.
How are you?
Terrific, thank you. It's great to have you with us. Also, Yale University literature professor Amy Hungerford. Hi, Amy.
Hi, Bill.
And novelist, Hollywood writer, producer John Ridley. Hi, John.
How you doing, Bill?
I'm great, thank you. Our first topic. In San Francisco, thousands of people turned out to see the running of the Olympic torch, and they got nothing. The mayor secretly switched the torch relay route. He says it was to maintain safety. Anti-China demonstrators say it thwarted their First Amendment right to protest. Was this torch hide-and-seek good news, bad news, or no news?
I thought this was great news.
Yeah?
It was all successful street theater. And what I loved about it was something that a director of the Save Darfur Foundation noted. It was as if the torch was running away from the demonstrators. So everybody stayed safe, and the demonstrators did get to make their point. And all the talk about what has happened with the rerouting has just given them even more press than they would have had before. So it's great.
Great news. Others?
I would say overall, no news to the point that every 4 years it's becoming more no news. Oh, the Olympics have been politicized by individuals or nations.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Olympics as either a political symbol, a corporate symbol, or a cheat magnet have honestly in these last bunch of quadrennials become so commonplace. I really think they ought to scrap the games. I really, really do.
No news. What about you, Simon?
I think it's bad news. I think I talked to a bunch of my friends in London who'd been to the demonstration, and most of those people haven't read a newspaper in 43 years and know very little about Tibet. And they're kind of going as some kind of weird station identification, like I'm a groovy person, so I'm going to go even though I don't even know where Tibet is.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's bad news. I love the Olympics. I look forward to it. I think it's better if it's not politicized and it's just a sporting event. So I think it's bad news.
Our next topic. The president of the Formula One Auto Racing Federation has been urged to resign. A British tabloid released a videotape of Max Mosley's participation in what the tabloid called a depraved Nazi sadomasochistic orgy. Mosley says, wait, there was nothing Nazi about it. Is this a fair good news, bad news, or no news?
It sounds like hot news to me.
Sounds like a Monty Python sketch to me, but what do you mean, Simon?
Well, I think probably this guy made a mistake in how he framed his S&M orgy. I think if you say, oh, it's going to be very sort of Berlin in the 30s and decadent and very cabaret, then you can get away with it. But once you get sort of all Achtung and start lashing people, you know, then that sort of takes it to a really unsavory place, I think.
Others?
I think bad news.
Bad?
Oh, yeah. First of all, Bill, honestly, whatever you're doing in the privacy of your own home is weird to somebody else.
Mm.
And the fact, you know, the minute this goes on tape, of course it looks bad. Anything out of context looks a little bad. Do you know what I mean? So the idea that you can't, this is not Elliot Spitzer. This is not Larry Craig. This is not David Vitter. This is not, I mean, he was a powerful person, but in a business that has absolutely nothing in particular to do with government responsibility or anything like that. And he was just having a little bit of weird fun.
Well, I'm with Simon that it's no news, but for different reasons. You know, oh, how shocking. Erotic fantasy is a stew of family romance in Freud's terms and of cultural fantasies of power. And it's not that surprising for someone in Max Mosley's position that this would come to have a place in his erotic life.
So I hear no one being disturbed at either the purported Nazi theme, the domination, the misogyny. No one's bothered here by his private actions.
If you take all that out, Bill, it's not a sex fantasy.
It's a tea party.
It is. It's a news conference.
It's bad news for me because it makes me feel like my my erotic life is just so incredibly Rebecca of Sunnybrook Farm and mm-hmm. vanilla. Mm-hmm. You know, because I think this guy's really, you know, getting creative, and I'm just, you know, having a cup of tea and watching American Idol.
Right.
Wow.
With my mother-in-law.
But can I go to what Amy said? This guy, Max Mosley, this cat who is doing all this nasty stuff, you know, his parents were accused during the Second World War of being Nazis.
His father was married at the home of Joseph Goebbels with Hitler as a guest of honor.
But is he related to Sir Oswald Mosley?
Yeah, that's his son. This is Oswald Mosley's son.
Oh, Jesus, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Now how do you feel?
It's a whole other... Oh, now I feel... I won't have to take my appetite suppressant now. That's really nasty.
Our next topic. Walmart recently fired its video production company. Now the company is replacing that lost revenue by selling footage of Walmart's internal board meetings. Footage of male Walmart managers parading in drag has appeared in an ad criticizing Walmart's attitude toward female employees. Is this production company's money-making scheme good news, bad news, or no news?
I can tell you that it's no news, because anybody who works in a large company, like every meeting we have at Barney's, someone's got a wig on or something, or there's a lot of clothes lying around. The meetings in the display department, I don't even want to go there. They make Mosley's parties look like nothing, I'm sure.
No news, says Simon. Others?
I think this is fantastic news for that American entrepreneurial spirit. So this company said, we are shot if we can't figure out how to make use of our resources. And I think they found a very good way of using them.
Wow. Machiavellian good news.
Yeah.
John?
I think this is bad news times two. To me. Mm-hmm. You have Walmart, a huge corporation that had had their meetings filmed since, I believe, the 80s by this company, never thought to have a non-disclosure form signed by these folks.
That was amazing. It's
the first thing you should know. If we're filming this, it's going to look bad to somebody. And then on the other end, this company that was doing the filming, this Flagler company, 95% of their business was Walmart. That nobody there thought, you know what, maybe we should diversify.
Well, yeah. I was as we're talking, I'm thinking, what's the downside for Walmart? I'm sure the human resources switchboard is jammed because people never imagined it was this fun, wacky, kooky place to work. So I don't see the downside for Walmart, why they would even care, quite honestly.
Possible good news for Walmart. That's the news this week. Panel, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Bill.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Amy Hungerford is a professor of literature at Yale U. Simon Doonan is creative director of Barney's New York. His latest book is called Eccentric Glamour, Creating an Insanely More Fabulous You. John Ridley has an NPR blog called Visible Man. His latest book, The American Way, is a graphic novel about a government-created team of superheroes.
Weekend America is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. This program is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, and KPCC Los Angeles.
Why do spoken word poets talk like that, and what's being done about it? Stay tuned to Weekend America. From American Public Media, this is Weekend America. Desiree Cooper is away. I'm Bill Radke. Most of us work Monday through Friday, and most of this show is geared that way. The weekend is time off. But I work weekends, and so do a lot of you, and we want to honor that, too, in this series we call The Weekend Shift. In St. Paul, the diners at Cafe 128 get to feast because head chef Ian Pierce and his team are on the job. Reporter Michael May paid a visit to Chef Pierce at his office, that is, the kitchen.
Saturday night, we have 60 seats in the restaurant, 40 people eating between 5 and 6 o'clock, and probably about another 100 for the rest of the night.
Chef Ian Pierce is still running around this small kitchen finishing prep work for the coming rush.
I got toasty foos in the oven.
I've known Ian since high school. He was sort of a hippie and class clown. It's fair to say he never lived up to his potential as a student. So I was a bit surprised when I read reviews calling him one of St. Paul's best chefs. I guess we all grow up. Sort of.
I wanna be your brother. You.
You got any lemons?
Yup. The prankster spirit is still intact and still serving the same purpose it did in high school, keeping everyone in good humor in the face of adversity. Ian runs his kitchen like a pirate's galley, even down to the stupid nicknames.
Charmin Ultra, BFO, Baby F***o.
What's up?
Niblet. Just tell him to get out of the way, Funkenstein.
That'd be me, in the way. And then to top it off, there's the one-handed dishwasher, Siggy Sue.
Met this guy here for 6 years, and he's awesome. I mean, the guy's got one hand, you know, and he's better than any dishwasher I've ever seen.
Funkenstein's pulling toasty poos out of the oven. BFO's hovering over the grill. Siggy Sue is a blur of suds and hot water. The temperature in here feels like 90 degrees. Everyone's sweating, and they've got 40 entrees to get out in the next hour.
I'm gonna give you up.
Things begin to unravel just as they're getting into the groove. Funkenstein breaks the Cajun cream sauce. It's got to be cooked at just the right temperature or the butter separates into an oily mess. And they run out of a key ingredient, Tabasco. So they decide to try harissa, a Moroccan spice.
That's about the best we're going to do at this point.
Hey, it's the same color, right?
Ian runs over to the stove, dumps the ingredients into a saucepan, and starts whisking like a madman.
Harissa, stock, cream, shallots. It seems like you definitely have to have a little bit of a masochistic mentality. We like to really just get killed with tickets. We love to just have a ton of people in the restaurant and just pound it out. It's thrilling.
But this torture does have its own rewards. A recent review said that Cafe 128 should win an Oscar for good food. But Ian maintains that it's more about hard work than artistic genius.
You know, you've got to be kind of humble about it. It's not like magic. Somebody wrote an article, and they talked about how I had culinary magic, and everybody around here is just laughing. So they say it all the time. Culinary magic. Oh, yeah, he's a real wizard over there.
The brew in the boiling cauldron is giving off an intoxicating aroma of butter and spice. Just in time. There are two grilled fillets of organic salmon waiting for their Cajun complement.
This Cajun sauce, which has now become Spanish cream sauce. Here's the thing, though. Some people might think of that as blasphemy, but it's going to taste great. And that's all that matters. Carmen, hit me up with a little bit of garlic in here, please.
The salmon gets sauced and heads out onto the floor. The dinner rush is over. And everyone looks a bit dazed. Dishes and ingredients litter the kitchen.
You know, at the end of the night, man, after you've been prepping and cooking for 12 hours straight, and then you look around and the place is a mess, and you're like, oh my gosh, I gotta clean. And then you somehow get through it, you know, maybe a few beers, maybe a couple shots, whatever's hiding in Funkenstein's locker. And then you come back the next day and do it again, and it's a lot of fun.
In St. Paul, I'm Michael May for Weekend America.
Chef Ian is on the weekend shift, and this weekend he is making the house special baby back ribs, featuring his handmade sauce and its 40 ingredients.
We'll
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
Desiree Cooper is away this week. I'm Bill Radke in Los Angeles. Check your local arts calendar this weekend, and you'll see a bloom of poetry readings, as happens every April, National Poetry Month. What's working against the poetry reading for some people is that sound, you know, that cadence, that poet speak. Where did that cadence come from, and why does it persist? That's what poet and radio producer Jeremy Richards wanted to know.
In 1932, the BBC captured the voice of the great... excuse me. I was overcome by a fit of poet voice there. But it's not my fault. The poet voice is an epidemic. Okay, in 1932, the BBC captured the poet voice of the great Irish bard William Butler Yeats. Even people who loved Yeats's poetry then would sometimes ask why he didn't take a more natural approach to reciting his poems. But Yeats was insistent.
I will not read them as if they were prose.
As a result, Yeats sometimes took a drubbing from critics for his otherworldly reading style.
And I shall have some peace there, for peace comes dropping slow, dropping from the veils of the morning to where the cricket sings.
Now, to the untrained ear, all poets may sound the same. But poets have voiced a wide range of styles for centuries. Yeats exemplifies what we'll call the sing-song voice. Anecdotal theories trace it to influential European poets with accented English. Others think the voice took on a new dimension during the drug-induced stupors of the Beatnik era. And then there's the jazz remix of the poet voice, popular in the spoken word world.
And then the moon shined, and it shone and shone and shone until the sun came out, and then that's what we make fun of in the spoken word world.
Poet and performer Krista Bell comes from a tradition of African diaspora, often informed by jazz, blues, and hip-hop. She thinks that past generations were just infusing musicality in their delivery. For generations since, it became like a family habit you pick up without knowing why.
Yeah, I would say that it would start from people copying people who are copying people. A lot of the old school poets, particularly from the African-American tradition, from Etheridge Knight and Amiri Baraka to Nikki Giovanni, the last poets had a style, and part of the style was talking like this and like this and like this, right?
Rhythm is important to all poets, but notice how the jazz and blues poets replace Yeats's measured sing-song with flashes of syncopation. Krista Bell picks up there, but adds the sort of cadence she grew up hearing as the daughter of a Pentecostal minister.
This poem's your whirling dervish, a full moon offering to the goddess. It's Martha and Mary weeping at the foot of the cross. This poem spoken in hieroglyphics, it's written in tongues. Woman, if you don't come, don't nobody come.
Yet while poets like Krista Bell are creating a new style, there's one aspect of the poet voice that still crops up with many performers, the upward inflection.
Ending every line going up.
That's four-time National Poetry Slam champion Taylor Mauley. He's been studying and mocking the way poets perform for almost 20 years. Here's his theory.
By turning declarative sentences into questions, they are, in essence, inviting the audience to answer these rhetorical questions with, yes, go on, yes, go on.
Poets in the slam community, like Mauley, have done their best to lose the upward inflection. But Mauley says in academic circles and at readings on college campuses, the inflection is still alive and well. In fact, it's almost taken for granted.
I think if you asked what, for lack of a better term, I need to call normal poets, regular poets, poets laureate, if you were to ask somebody like Robert Pinsky why poets read the way they do, Robert Pinsky would probably say that he's merely trying to read in a sort of a neutral tone.
Do you mean when people read in a spaced out way?
Actually, I spoke with Pinsky, and he makes fun of academic poets just like Mauley does.
Oh, damn it. Then I guess I agree with Robert Pinsky.
Pinsky, by the way, is the former U.S. poet laureate. And, yeah, he's one of the first in line to mock the poet voice in all its forms.
Or when it's bad ham acting.
When people read in a spaced-out way.
Robert Pinsky's known for being an advocate for making poetry more open to everyone. In 1997, Pinsky took the post of poet laureate and introduced the Favorite Poem Project.
He invited everyday Americans to share their poetry picks to showcase a wide range of voices.
Who can remember back to the first poets, the greatest ones, greater even than Orpheus?
From Hillary Clinton reciting Howard Nemirov there, to Jamaican-born photographer Seth Rodney invoking Sylvia Plath.
You are the one solid the spaces lean on, envious.
According to Robert Pinsky, this diversity, this natural expression of voice, is where a poem comes to life.
I believe that it is a vocal art. It's true that poetry isn't speech. It's not song either. It's somewhere on a line between speech and song, that it's a special kind of discourse, that it's speech plus something.
And when Pinsky recites his own poetry, he keeps at least one criterion in mind.
I hope I don't bore audiences. You know, you don't want to make this, it's not school, it's not church, it's art. It's supposed to be a pleasure.
And that's worth remembering. If you go to a poetry reading, you're bound to hear a few odd inflections. But the poet voice of yore is dying out, giving way to a more natural sound. So embrace the new poet voice, I say. The way you embrace the public radio voice. You know, that soothing consistency of a refrigerator hum, always there, constant and knowing. That public radio voice you know will always glide along and then slow down, just so, right as a story is about to end. For Weekend America, I'm Jeremy Richards.
This weekend, Jeremy Richards is in New York City performing his own poetry. Last night, he headlined at the New Yorican Poets Cafe. Next Tuesday, he's at the Bowery Poetry Club. This is Weekend America. Umami is the fifth taste sensed by the tongue. It's Japanese for savory or meaty. And Umami is a food and art festival happening this weekend in New York City. For that festival, composer Fast Forward, that's his real name, Fast Forward has been commissioned to write a piece of music. Fast is best known for his composition, Feeding Frenzy, where musicians play and cooks cook and waiters serve. For his latest composition, his instruments are nothing but kitchen utensils and foodstuffs.
The combination of food in an art context seems to be very, very attractive to people. I came up with a piece that I call Musique à la mode, and it's a piece using a large variety of different kitchen utensils, from popcorn poppers to blenders and kettles. This is one of the sections. It's stainless steel bowls, upside down, played with OXO Good Grip flexible turners. These sauce pots that I got in Chinatown, apparently in all the restaurants, they use these rather good quality stainless steel sauce pots that have a very nice ring to them. Maybe you can listen to them. When I decided that I was going to do this piece with all these kitchen utensils, I realized that a lot of shopping was going to be involved. And for the last 3 months or so, I've been making a beeline to all the kitchen utensil stores, both in New York and in the surrounding area of about 100 miles. You know, I find most things musical. I mean, I would find chomping on some chips musical or walking in a puddle musical. It's just a matter of to what degree they are musical, being that you can be in a store and pick something up that you think is going to be interesting sonically, and then I usually hit it with my hand and it either lets out a melodious ring or just a ungrateful thud. There's something to do with food that people like. That's probably an understatement. So it's sort of like it's a good tip or a secret. If you're an artist, put some food in there and it's more likely to be successful.
That's composer Fast Forward playing an excerpt from his new work, Musique à la Mode. The Umami Festival is promoting more than music. Earlier this week, they hosted the Orphic Memory Sausage Event. That's where the audience brings something that evokes a memory, could be shoes or dried fish, and these memories are gathered, smashed into a pulp, and then artists and the audience stuff that pulp into sausage casings, which are dried and given out as souvenirs. This is Weekend America. The Umami Festival might be best enjoyed indoors this weekend. New York is warm with showers today and cold with showers tomorrow. Here's John Moe with the rest of your weekend weather.
Grits, not just for breakfast, also for community events. St. George, South Carolina hosts the World Grits Festival with grits grinding, grits eating, and rolling around in grits, plus beauty queens who probably avoided rolling around in grits. 79 and thunderstorms, what does a bowl of grits struck by lightning taste like? Spicy? Smoky? Splattered all over the walls? There are ski races, then there's what Paxson, Alaska does. Begin at 5,800 feet, drop 1,700 feet in less than 2 miles into a canyon, then grab a tow rope and get pulled at 86 miles an hour over the side of another mountain and drop to the finish line. Snow, 28 degrees. The official motto of the race? Ah! How true that is. Weekends are for family, fathers and daughters, mothers and sons, or if you're in Moulton, Alabama, chickens and eggs. 67 and sunny at the Alabama Chicken and Egg Festival. Contest for clucking, wing and hard-boiled egg eating, and something called chicken karaoke. The event was almost canceled after a long existential debate about how it first began. For information on these and other events, go to weekendamerica.org. With a little bit of weather everywhere, I'm John Moe for Weekend America.
When you can guess a guy's golf handicap just by shaking his hand, you're ready to be a hustler. Meet one of the best next on Weekend America.
Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Online at calvert.com.
From American Public Media, welcome to the weekend. Desiree Cooper is away. I'm Bill Radke in Los Angeles. The 72nd Masters Golf Tournament is underway this weekend at the exclusive Augusta National Golf Club in Georgia. Exclusive, that is a word often associated with this sport. But golf has always had its outsiders. Weekend America's Charlie Schroeder met one of the best at a municipal golf course in Los Angeles, a golf pro who was first a golf hustler.
One weekend, back in 1950, Al Duhon decided he'd go play golf. So he went to his local public golf course.
And this guy jumped on my back. He said, come on, let's bet. I didn't know what betting was. I didn't know whether he was... I said, bet? Yeah, okay. I thought you had to say okay, you know, so...
Duhon was 25 at the time and hadn't played the game very much. Furthermore, he didn't really get golf, especially the people who played no matter what the weather.
You know what I mean? I said, gee, them guys out there in the rain and everything. I said, they gotta be crazy.
So Duhon wasn't much competition for his opponent.
When we finished, he said, you owe me $25. I said, $25? See, you gotta be kidding. So I had to pay him. That was my last money. Didn't have any more money at all.
Duhon may not have had any money, but what he did have was an epiphany. And this was it.
Jesus Christ. I didn't know it was money in this game.
After losing that bet, Duhon practiced in his South Los Angeles yard for 6 months straight. He'd hit chip shots back and forth over his car. He'd even launch balls over his neighbor's homes and onto a schoolyard more than 200 yards away. Once his game was sufficiently in shape, he went back out to the golf course.
Went back out there, beat that guy out of my $25.
The game Duhon once labeled crazy had bit him. Hard.
Just like taking dope, you know what I mean? Playing golf. A guy falls in love with it so much. I mean, it's just something you just can't get away from.
That Al started playing golf at all might surprise most people. For one thing, his parents didn't play. For another, he grew up in Depression-era segregated Beaumont, Texas.
My family was so poor that we used to put cardboards in our shoes, you know. And they were always, shoes were always too big. And we had to kind of walk on our heels from my house to the paved street, you know, to keep from walking in the water, you know.
When Duhon was 7, he started hustling for his family after his father was blackballed for unionizing at the local oil refinery. Consider his resourcefulness after the local Baptist church wouldn't give him bread because his family was Catholic. Duhon called on his rather intimidating dog, Black Beauty.
My dog came in with me, and they tried to take that bread away from me. Boy, that dog raised all kind of hell. So I just took the bread and went on home with him.
Here's a little golf history for you, circa 1960, 10 years after Al first bet on the golf course. There weren't any African Americans on the PGA Tour. In fact, there wouldn't be until the next year when Charlie Sifford finally broke the color barrier. In 1960, Duhon was making $105 a week working at a plastics factory, but he was making nearly that much in one day on the golf course.
If I'd go out there and play on like on a Sunday and win me about $50, you know what I mean?
Later that year, the plastics company where Duhon worked was sold. Rather than getting another job, he turned to hustling golf full-time.
And I'd say, well, I'll just play golf. I knew I could win me at least $150, $200 a week, so that's what I did.
Now, this idea that golfers hustle might seem a bit strange. I mean, isn't that what happens in pool halls? But on any given day, Duhon could play in games where $1,000 was on the line. Games that mostly took place at Chester, Washington, a golf course in South Los Angeles known as a hustling hotbed.
When I walk up there, they say, oh, here comes Al Duhon, come on, let's go. And then you didn't have to worry about getting your bags out of the car. They will help you get your bags out of the car.
Duhon became so savvy that he developed a pre-match betting strategy.
My method was if I shook a guy's hand and he had coins in his hand.
That's to say, calluses.
He's dead. I know I'm going to beat him.
Because golfers who don't know how to hold the club don't know how to play.
In one position, he had the wrong grip. Next position, he had his club in his hand too weak because it's rubbing up and down. Or he either had it too tight in his hand and it gets away from him and makes coins in your hand.
Despite making his living on the golf course, Duhon desperately wanted to be taken seriously. And it finally happened for him in 1982 when he was 52 years old. That year, he was the only black golfer competing in the U.S. Senior Amateur in Tucson. During his practice round, a reporter approached him.
So he asked me, what am I doing there? I said, I'm doing here to kick somebody's ass. That's what I said. I said, I'm here to kick somebody's ass. That's what I'm here for. So the guy wrote it up in the paper, and everybody was speaking to me.
Turns out nobody had to speak to him. Duhon won the tournament to become only the second African-American to win a USGA title.
When I got through playing in 36 holes that day, I drove all the way back to L.A. without even getting sleepy, thinking about what happened in my lifetime. You know what I mean? So that was the greatest moments of my life.
At the age of 65, Duhon finally turned pro. He played a few years on the senior tour, continued to hustle, and in his spare time taught kids in South L.A. about the game. Now he's 83 and still teaching things like how to hold the club and...
respect, how to dress. If you dress like a fool, they're gonna treat you like a fool.
As for hustling?
No, I don't hustle anymore. But if a guy bet, you know, I'll bet him. You know what I mean?
My money's on Al. I'm Charlie Schroeder for Weekend America.
Al Duhon has never played Augusta National, where the Masters is happening this weekend. But 2 years ago, he traveled to the home of golf, St. Andrews, Scotland, with his students and the golfer Charlie Sifford. It was the first time either man had played the course. This weekend, Al will watch the Masters tournament and teach golf to kids in South L.A. on Saturday. No golf on Sunday. He says that's the Lord's Day. To see what Al Duhon's swing looks like now at 83, visit weekendamerica.org. And that's it for another hour of American Public Media's Weekend America. The show is produced by Ben Adair, Julia Barton, Angela Kim, Jim Gates, Millie Jefferson, E. Okobi, Philip Stearns, Sam Keenan, Michael Rayfield, and Tim Bomba, Rob Byers, Susie Lechtenberg, Chrissy Clark, Brendan Noonan, Michael May, David Banks, Phyllis Owens, John Moe, and Mark Sanchez. Galactic created our theme music. Our executive producer is Peter Clowney. Jim Russell created the show. You can get a free podcast of today's program at weekendamerica.org. I'm Bill Radke. Desiree Cooper will be back next time. I hope she's enjoying her weekend and that you are too.
This program is made possible with support from AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio, and public radio stations including WMFE Orlando, KUOW Seattle, and KNOW St. Paul, and made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by
American Public Media.
Hi, I'm Bill Radke, host of Weekend America. The weekends are for exploring.
I've really enjoyed Georgia. It's been extremely rural, very friendly.
For the 10 dogs that are running toward us right now.
That really is. Let's cross the street.
It was really scary because I thought they were going to capsize our boat. When you got fish attacking you, that's wrong.
Becoming one with nature, plus a whole lot more. It's Weekend America every Saturday. Join us.